Okay, top of 63, we're going to do the third step promises. So remember to keep this explanation of these basic instincts handy, because we're going to use it when we get to step four here in a few minutes. When we sincerely took such a position, these are the third step promises. These are the third step promises. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Watch your capitals here. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life as we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered what we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence. We began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. I am not the person that was born on May 24th, 1954. I am just not that person. That was an eating machine, an eating, lying machine. That is a person who did not know how to function in the world. We talked about turkey vultures. I was an ostrich. I stuck my hand in the sand every time, my head in the sand, every time and any time there was a need to look at life. And if there was a need to look at something unpleasant, my fear, my insecurities would not allow me to look at that. And I would stick my head in the sand, and the only thing I got was a lot of sand in my eyes, nose, and mouth. It never protected me from anything. I would lie when the truth would have served me better. I have done horrible, deplorable things with money, and I have manipulated people, and I have lied to people that love me. And I have manipulated people that love me. And I lied when the truth would have served me better. I have lived by myself, alone, hating the world for not giving me what I wanted and contributed nothing to it. When I started contributing to the world, little by little, by and by, when I looked at these promises, they all come true in my life. There have been some rocky times. After the divorce, I didn't know how I was going to make it. I really did not know how I was going to make it. My ex-wife and my daughter, they were really the only family I've ever known. But I do have some wonderful friends, but I did not know how I was going to make it. It isn't just the marriage that I missed. It was the fact that when you are married like that, like I was, you have sort of a membership card to the human race. You're married, you have a family. And when you're alone, it's very tough. And being my age, all of my friends are either married or they were going out with girls. So I, like, Sunday would be a torture for me. Just a torture for me. Because I wouldn't, you know, Sunday is a tough day to play with boys. Boys go with their families, they go with their wives, they go with their children, their grandchildren now because we're getting older. They go with their families on Sunday and there's really no one to play with. You know, I sound like I'm 8 years old, but that's, you know, the emotions. But the bottom line is, today I have a very full life. I'm very active in so many things, Vision for You being one of them. I just did another special edition on Sunday. And if you send me an email, I'll send you all my podcasts, except for that one. I don't have that one on there yet, but I'll send you all the podcasts I've done. But the phone doesn't stop ringing. The phone just on Sundays, just, or any day, it really doesn't stop ringing. I sometimes start taking outreach calls at 3:15, 3:30 in the morning, you know, my time. And it's fine. It's perfectly okay. This is the greatest way of life in the world. Okay, we are now at step three. Many of us said to our maker as we understood him. Don't make me say this by myself. Say it with me. If you really want to say it, if you don't want to say it, don't. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt, relieving me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that I may bear with them, may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. We thought, well, before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. The amen comes in at the seventh step prayer, not third. There's no amen at the third step. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor, but it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning. Remember I told you that the third step is a beginning and a decision, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. Now, we're going to get a lot of questions in OA about how to do your fourth step and when to do your fourth step. There's two timetables. It says next, and then on the next page, it's going to tell us to do it at once. Three always precedes four. Four always follows three. You have people telling people in OA to wait 6 months. You have telling people to take a year, to take a month. Those are all death sentences. You do it right away. The four steps should not take more than about 2-3 hours at the most. There's no reason you're not getting a doctorate from Berkeley, or you're not getting a doctorate from Dartmouth. A four-step inventory shouldn't take more than about 2-3 hours. If you were starting it today, we should be able to do step five by tonight, or we should be able to do step five certainly by tomorrow. There's absolutely no reason. If you hear some of my podcasts on Vision for You. If you don't know Vision, it's a vision for the number four, you. It's part of OA, it's fine. There's a woman from Atlanta, she'll ask me a question like she's been working on her four step for 1 year. I says, is somebody trying to kill you? I says, there's no way you should be working on a four step for a year. You know who you're mad at, what they did to you. You know who or what you fear. You know the sexual harms you've done others. No reason it should take more than about 2-3 hours, tops. Tops. Okay, it says neck. Yes. Question.
Going back quickly, what is the significance, as you would describe it, in not saying amen after the third step prayer?
I don't know. Bill would be the only one that would really know that, but I'm just suspicious that you have to complete these steps before you get the amen, and then you start with step eight. But I really don't know. That was a secret that I never discovered in Bill's writing. Next, not in a year, not in a month, not in a week. Next, we launch on a course of vigorous thinking. No, vigorous action. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning. What do you mean by the first step of which is a personal house cleaning? Because this is the first of the action steps. The first three steps are conclusions of the mind. This is the first step that we're going to do that is going to be an action step, is step four. We launched on, which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted, though our decision is step three, was a vital and crucial step. It could have little permanent effect unless at once. So we see next and at once. When do you do your fourth step? As the minute you've done with three. Not in a week, not in a year, not in a decade, next. Have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom. In other words, liquor was not the problem. Liquor was a symptom of the illness, and the illness rests in the mind and the body. Okay? So we had to get down to causes and conditions. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Now, I want to talk to you about resentment. I hate this time of the day because a lot of you are just kind of fading out, and I am too. We're going to get through this, and I'm going to do the best I can. resentment is something that we're going to deal with. Now, why do I love a resentment? At my house right now, on my recorder, my DVR, I have a copy on my DVR of the Oregon Ducks beating the University of Arizona at basketball not long ago, like 2 weeks ago. They just kicked their ass. It was beautiful. It was a beautiful thing to watch. And it was gorgeous. It was just magnificent. If there was a test on that recording, I would get 100 on that test. I doubt anyone could beat me on that. I know every basket, I know every commercial, I know what the announcers are going to say, I know everything they're going to say on that recording. I would get a 100, I'd get a high A on that test. Okay? That recording has something that I lack sorely. And what I lack sorely is something that that recording has, which is fidelity. What is fidelity? Truth and consistency. Truth and consistency. I lack that. Because if you hurt me in 1966, and I'm playing that, I have a resentment replay machine in my head. And every morning when I get up, I play back what you did to me in 1966. And then I replay what you did to me in 1971. And then I replay what you did to me in 1977. And I replay what you did to me in 1983. And I replay what you did to me at all the various times that you hurt my feelings. And I have a resentment replay machine that I can fire up in the morning, but it isn't like the recording of the basketball game. Because in my mind, I take that recording, or I take that incident, and I change it just a little bit every time I replay it, to the point where I was standing there doing nothing, and you came along and you did me dirt. And I also have my get even machine. The next time I see you, or the next time you try to pull that crap on me, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to say this, and I'm not going to take your crap anymore. And the resentment has a payoff. What is the payoff to a resentment, you ask? Well, the payoff to a resentment is I do not have to take any responsibility for my own life, because I can resent you and I can abdicate responsibility to you, and I no longer have to take responsibility for me. Because if you hadn't have done that to me, I wouldn't be the way I am today. That's why we love a good resentment. Oh, give me a resentment and I'm just orgasmic. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. It's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. I love a resentment because it'll allow me to justify the most errant nonsense imaginable. And it will allow me to continue to eat and continue to screw people out of money and lie and write bad checks. Because it was all your fault. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From its stem, all forms of spiritual disease. I'm at the bottom of 64. For we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, here's your instruction. We set them on paper. Column one in the resentment section, who or what do you resent? Who or what do you resent? We all know who or what we resent. Not always going to be a who. I had a strong resentment against an expression called blood is thicker than water. When people would say blood is thicker than water, I was immediately left out. I was excluded because I didn't know. For a long time, I didn't have any relatives in the world, so I was immediately left out. I had resentments against people. I bet you do too. Column one, who or what do you resent? Column two, we listed people, institutions, or principals with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. Column two, what did they do to you in 19 words or less? Do not write a damn book about what they did to you. That is not the purpose of this. Where did I get 19 words or less? Because in the example on the next page, that's the most amount of words Bill allows for anybody to go on and on about their resentments. You don't have to write the whole story. Just give the headlines. What did they do to you? In keeping with we asked ourselves why we were angry, column three, what basic instincts were affected in this resentment against whoever? What basic instinct or instincts were affected in this resentment? Column one, or what do you resent? Column two, what did they do to you? 19 words or less. Column three, basic instinct or instincts. And then column four, we'll get to on page 67. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened, so we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations, which had been interfered with? We were usually as definite as this example. We're not going to have time to go over more than one example. Mr. Brown. Why do I resent Mr. Brown? Oh, he's paying attention to my wife. Well, that affects my sex relations, my self-esteem, and my fear. What's the fear here? The fear here is if he runs off with my wife, I'm going to lose my house. What are my kids going to think? What are my friends going to think? What's her relatives going to think? What are my relatives going to think? She's going to take my money. That's the fear. Told my wife of my mistress. So he's worried about Brown paying attention to his wife, and Mr. Lucky Pants over there has a mistress. Again, affects his sex relations, self-esteem, fear. What's the fear? If his wife finds out he has a mistress, she's probably going to take his money, take his house, take his kids, take his whatever, and that'll be the end of that. Brown may get my job at the office. What instinct? Security instinct. We just talked about that. Self-esteem, fear. So what's the self-esteem? Well, if he gets my job at the office, I'm going to feel like a putz. I'm going to feel like a real loser. If he takes my wife, I'm going to feel like a loser. And this is where this is coming from. The fear like that is the fear of what's going to happen if this happens. Go to the bottom of 65. We went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. Now, very self-explanatory. Let's keep going. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. You ever see people that are angry all the time? They're never happy people. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found it is fatal. How is it fatal? Because the buildup of these emotions will drag me by the hair into the food. The food will trigger the allergy. The allergy will make it impossible for me to stop. Once I'm unable to stop, I'm going to eat food that is going to endanger my health. And if I endanger my health enough, I'm going to die. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. How much more of a warning can he give you? How much more plain can he make it? These are the instructions. The instructions are in the big book. They're not anywhere else. This is the instructions. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. The grouch is somebody who's mad all the time. And the brainstorm is somebody who's just mad once in a while, but when they are, watch out. So these are words that we don't hear anymore, but the grouch and the brainstorm, the grouch is the guy that's mad all the time. Brainstorm is these impetuous bouts of anger. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. We turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course. We realized that people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us to show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Now here's your sick man prayer. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. I must say that prayer 20 times, 50 times a day. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Now, here's your instruction for column 4 in the resentment inventory. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Boy, I don't like doing that. I don't mind looking at what you did wrong, but I sure as hell don't want to look at what I did wrong. Oh my God. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them, we placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight. So in other words, the fourth column of your resentment inventory should be, what did you do to set this in motion and what character defects were brought to the surface? Now, I hear good. I hear real good. And I know what some of you are saying. We just talked about the fact that statistically speaking, I am in a room with people who have been molested by their parents or parent. Statistically speaking, I am also in a room with people that were raped. And statistically speaking, I am in a room with people that have had abortions or something that they regret strongly. And I'm in a room with people that have had injustices done in their lives that they had nothing to do with. I understand about that. Remember who my dad was? Did he do anything to cause this murder? No, I don't think so. He was 14 years old when this occurred. He didn't invite those people into the home to tell them to kill everybody. They had already killed, because there were several houses on the estate, they had already killed the extended family. They were all dead. And the bottom line is that he was a victim of injustice. I remember going to meetings years ago with a woman named Shirley, lovely woman. And Shirley lived in Skokie, Illinois, which is a nice neighborhood now, but it was an even nicer neighborhood then. And it was a very kind of, I can't get this to stay. Anyways, it was even a nicer, thanks Amy. It was even a nicer neighborhood then than it is now. And one day, her 16-year-old daughter fell in love with Mr. Wrong. She fell in love with the guy that was always giving the finger to the cops, and he was in the motorcycle and drinking and getting into trouble, and she fell in love with that guy. You know that guy. And when she tried to break up with him, he came to the house and blew her brains out. She answered the door, he shot her right in the face. And it was on the front page of newspapers, and we had 4 newspapers in those days, we have TV stations, because murders are not supposed to happen in that neighborhood, made it even more sensational. So she stopped coming to meetings for a couple of years, maybe 3 years. One day I see this little hunched over woman with pure white hair coming in and sitting in the back of the room, and it was her. It was her. And she said, "That son of a bitch dragged us through the mud of courts and police and prosecutors and took my daughter away from us. He took years of my life, and that son of a bitch isn't getting one more minute." We've dragged these resentments around long enough. They don't serve any good purpose. Many of the people that are controlling our lives are dead. Many of the people that are controlling our lives do not even remember us. And some of the people that are controlling our lives and ruining our lives, and they're not ruining them, they're causing us to ruin our own lives, are people that are long gone out of our life. It's time to let the rapist go. I know that's hard to hear, but how much of a price are we willing to pay? How much of a price are we willing to pay? We've already paid long enough, and we've paid deep enough. It's time to let it go. And if we don't have the willingness to let it go, we will pray for that willingness, because to carry this around, to carry this around, it's not healthy for us. We're killing ourselves now. We're doing it to ourselves now. Now that we know better, we're doing it to ourselves. And we have to stop doing it. Can I do that without God's help? Absolutely not. I can't do anything without God's help. I have to leave retribution to heaven. Leave retribution to the Father of all light. That light is capable of handling these resentments, while I, as a compulsive, ultimately human being, am not. The people that laughed at me, the people that made fun of me, the people that slapped my stomach, the people that took food off my table in restaurants that I didn't even know, and handed it to the busboy and said, "He doesn't need this," I have to let that go. They've already hurt me enough. I don't want them to hurt me anymore. I don't need any more pain. And what's worse is not just the pain. What's worse is it causes the buildup of everyday human emotion. And when those emotions build to a certain level, I'm going to seek out the comfort of food, because I'm looking for the effect. And that effect is going to give me about 8 seconds worth of solace from this pain, and then the physical allergy is triggered, and I can't stop, and it sets, and I will repeat that cycle over and over and over again. The mind telling me that it's perfectly okay to eat the food, while the body ensures it indeed is not. Let's move to the fear inventory. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It is an evil and corroding thread. It's a tough crowd. I got you guys sweating and taking off your garments. Now I've got you guys putting everything back on. This is a tough room up here, I'm telling you. This is a tough room. Okay, this short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. Did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. Column 1 in the fear inventory. It's a 4-column resentment inventory, 4-column fear, 5-column sex with a side assignment. Very simple. The fear inventory, column 1. Who or what do you fear? Okay. We asked ourselves why we had them. Okay. Second column. Why do you fear it? third column, what instinct or instincts is what instinct or instincts is brought into play. And then the fourth column again is, what did you do to set this fear in motion? What did you do to set this in motion? Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, excuse me, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Perhaps there's a better way, we think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do it as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be, and once we commence to outgrow fear. Again, the fear column, the fear inventory. Column one, who or what do you fear? Column two, why do you fear it? 19 words or less, please. Column three, what basic instinct or instincts are affected? Column four, what did you do to set the ball in motion, if anything? I'm not going to take questions and answers now, but is there anything there that you feel you need a PhD from Yale or Harvard to do? Seriously speaking, you know who you resent or what. You know what they did to you. You know what basic, and if you need help with the basic instincts, that's what a sponsor is for. If you're having trouble finding your part in these things, that's what a sponsor is for. That's what we're there for. Okay, Michelle, what's your question? I'm sorry.
Just an example of what did you do to get the ball rolling. Is that the same as what you did in the fourth column of the...
Exactly the same. Okay. And what defects were brought to the surface? In other words, I didn't pay my taxes for a number of years. I was above that sort of thing. So I feared the IRS. One day they came in and started garnishing my wages. Well, what did I do? I didn't pay my taxes. Why not? What basic instincts were affected? Well, the security instinct, I don't want to give up the money. What defects of character? Defects of character and instincts are different. What defects of character? Selfishness, I wanted them to stick to the script. Fear, I didn't want to give up the money. Dishonesty, plain damn dishonesty. Everybody else pays taxes, and I didn't want to pay taxes. I wasn't making any money, and I was plain damn dishonest. Now about sex. Yay! Okay. Now about sex. Okay. Now, we're going to go to the bottom of page 68. Now, I'm going to give you an opinion. This is not OA's opinion. This is not AA's opinion. This is my opinion. I believe that God gave us the sex instinct so that we could either, not and, but either, and with both sometimes, enjoy it between consenting adults, or to also recreate ourselves. Now, am I saying you can only have sex to have a baby? I am not saying that. I said or and either. Remember that? I said you can either do it to enjoy it or do it to recreate yourself, which would be both. But if you're doing it for some other reason, these may be the very things that we're talking about, and these may be the very things that are causing us these problems. Now, what are some of the ways that we harm each other in this sexual area? Well, one of the more obvious ways is cheating. He cheated on me, she cheated on me, they cheated, whatever. And that's fine. Now, again, I just want to be very, very clear. I am not talking just about heterosexual contact. This could be same sex, this could be heterosexual. This is not my business. We are not the arbiters of anyone's sexual conduct. And whether you have heterosexual conduct or you have same sex conduct is okay by me. I am fine either way. We're good. Cheating is obvious. Now, let's say I'm using my God-given sex instincts for something other than what they are intended for. Let's just say that I'm acting in a flirtatious manner with a supervisor at the office, not because I want to enjoy sex and not because I want to recreate myself, but by acting in a coquettish manner, I might be able to fulfill my security instinct if I keep this guy on the line and I make him think that there might be something between us, I can further my security instinct. Now let's just say, for example, also, just another example, I am using sex to harm another person. In other words, I have a friend, and let's call him Joe. Now, Joe and Mary, they are a couple, but Joe is really pissing me off. Joe is just on my bad list. He's on that bad list. So I seduce Mary and have sex with Mary just to hurt Joe. Does enjoyment have anything to do with that? No. I might enjoy the sex, but it really has nothing to do with what we're talking about. And so I'm using sex for something other than what it was intended for. Also, what if I am in a committed relationship and my partner is asking me to do something for them that I've been very reluctant to do? Or they are asking me not to make demands on them to do something that they'd really rather not do. So if I am making demands on them, or if I'm reluctant to give in once in a while to their demands, that is a harm that I have done to this other person. Perhaps I'm using sex for something other than what it was intended for. These are the things I must take a look at. Am I using, and this is my opinion again, don't throw this at me. This is my opinion, I'm entitled to it. I believe that for me, not for you, for me, I cannot be working the 12 steps while I'm breaking the 10 commandments. That doesn't work for me. I do not believe I can work the steps while I'm breaking the Ten Commandments. I don't believe that those things are congruent. I know that there are people who are polyamorous, and if that is the condition in which you enter into a relationship that is going to be polyamorous, God bless you. But if I've entered into what is supposed to be a monogamous relationship, I do not step outside that relationship, no matter what the temptation is. I do not step outside of it. I do not believe I can be working the steps while I'm breaking the commandments. What about withholding sex or withholding affection? Let's just say, for example, I'm married to a gal and she happens to be a Dodgers fan, but I want her to be a Cub fan. Well, I'll show her. I'll cut her off at the pass and I won't be affectionate with her at all. I won't touch her. I won't be nice to her until she comes around in my way of thinking. That's also using my God-given sex powers for something other than what it was intended for. If I'm flirtatious with somebody to create jealousy, just to be mean to her or just to manipulate her, this is also something that is a problem and it's hurting other people in this sexual area. Okay. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we try to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes. I'm at the bottom of 68. Absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't, but what can we do about them? We reviewed our conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. Column one in the sex instinct. Column one, who did you hurt? This will always be a who. Unless you have sex with turkey vultures or you have sex with something else. This will be a who. Who did you hurt? Column two. What did you do to them or not do? Column three. What basic instinct or instincts are affected? Column four. What defects of character were brought to the surface in the harm you did in column two? And then column five. What should you have done instead? Column one, who did you hurt? Column two, what did you do to them? 19 words or less, please. Column three, what basic instinct or instincts are affected? Column one, who did you hurt? Column two, what'd you do? Column three, instincts. Column four, what defects were brought to the surface? Column five, what should you have done instead? Remembering that a hammer to your head is not one of the tools of recovery. So when you think, what should you have done instead? Be gentle with yourself, but be truthful with yourself. Be gentle, but honest. A hammer to your head is not one of the tools of recovery.
It wasn't a fifth column for the others, was it?
No, there is not. Sex is the only one with a fifth column and a side assignment. Okay, Rivera. In this way, we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. I have a sexual ideal based on the mistakes that I've made. I went on my first date with a girl when I was 35 years of age. I was emasculated physically, and I was emasculated emotionally by this disease at a very early age. I was not really a man. I couldn't stand here naked and prove to you that I was, because the fat had consumed me. I was damaged by this emotionally. I was damaged by this in every way you can be damaged by this. This is not something I signed up for. This is something that came upon me like a tsunami. And I married the first girl that came along that didn't use the dreaded F word, friend. When she didn't use the F word, friend, and she wanted to get married, I married her. And there were problems right from the beginning. I never felt really comfortable with her. We didn't click sexually at all. And there were problems. But she was a good person. And I owe her a tremendous debt of gratitude. If it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be a father. If it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have the business. I said to her, you can't teach school anymore. You gotta come with me in the business. Because I can't afford to go hire somebody and I need you. She cried for days and came to work, rolled up her sleeves, and helped me build that business, and I wouldn't have it today if she didn't. She is a wonderful person. I wish her nothing but the best. I do not have a bad word to say about her at all. She is a wonderful person that happened to have fallen in love with someone else, and we got divorced 6 years ago. What did I learn from the marriage? Well, from the very onset of the marriage, I was not a husband, I was a child. I was a dependent child. And she was the mother and I was the son. And I stood in the corner and shivered and feared her every reaction for fear that she would run away from me. And eventually she did. I didn't participate in the marriage as an adult is supposed to participate. I participated in the marriage like a child. Whatever she wanted, we did. So I held on to these resentments. I held on to these feelings. I learned that if I'm going to ever be in a marriage again or in a relationship again, I need to be an adult. I need to be a person that stands on his own feet. I also learned that when the business was good, our relationship was okay, but when the business went south, we had nothing. We also didn't touch each other for the last 10 years of that marriage. I was married to this woman for about 18 years. We got pregnant the first and only time we tried. If we had sex 20 times in the marriage, that was a lot. I learned an incredible amount from the experience, and I learned that we're not talking the last days of Caligula here, but at least there has to be some sexual activity in a marriage. There has to be something. I mean, every once in a while, you better be really glad to see me, and I better be really glad to see you, or what the hell are we doing here? I don't need another roommate, because we weren't really husband and wife, we were roommates. That's really what we were, was roommates. And I learned that that's not okay. I also learned the importance of being an adult, making money to the best of your ability, that it's not an issue in the marriage, it's the issue in the marriage. I learned that I really can't be with somebody that's not in recovery. My ex-wife is fine, she's in recovery, but the bottom line is I need to be with somebody that speaks and understands the language of the heart. And that's not a bad thing, it's just who I am. I don't think I could really be in a relationship with somebody who doesn't understand this. I don't think I really could be. Maybe I could, I don't know. I hope I don't get the chance, because I just started dating this gal and I'm hoping that this will catch on. We live in different states, which is difficult. We have a geography problem, but we'll see where God, you know, what God can. So these are the things, among other things, that I learned. I can't think of being an adult, being an independent adult, sex, the money. These are the things I have learned from the mistakes that I made in the past. I also am not quite experienced in these matters of sex and relationship like other guys are, because I never went through it. And there's two things in sports you can't fix: speed and experience. So I never went through a lot of these things. I never had a chance to break up with anybody. So when the relationship with this woman was really good, it never occurred to me to break up with her, because I finally caught a fish. I wasn't going to throw it back. And as bad as it was, I just endured it. I weathered it out. I sucked it up. Because the worst thing I could think of to be was alone. I didn't want to be alone for the rest of my life, and it never occurred to me that if I broke up with her, or she with me, that we could find someone else. It just never occurred to me. I clearly understood she could find someone else. I just doubted very seriously if I ever could. So these are some of the things that reared their ugly head in my relationship life that I put on my idea. Now in this new thing, I gotta say, everything is pretty checked off. She's understanding of my lack of experience. As a matter of fact, she likes it. She finds it refreshing that I haven't been with half the world. But I wish, I'm coming back as an alcoholic, damn it. I'm coming back as an alcoholic. I'm gonna be the bad boy. I'll never get a chance to go to prom, I'll never get a chance to go to homecoming, I'll never have a chance to kiss a girl in the hallway at the high school, I'll never have a chance to go to whatever, I'll never have the college lover that got away that brings a smile to my face. I'll never have those things. I'll never be able to go back and have those moments with a female. And I'm sorry for me for that. But I have a chance to live now with somebody who's really awesome. I can't live with her, she lives in a different state. But hopefully this is something, and if it doesn't happen, if it breaks up, if it doesn't come to fruition, then I'll just do the next right thing and let God work his magic. And he'll be the final arbiter of all this stuff. It is tough to be alone, and I hope I don't have to be. But if I am, then if that's my destiny, then I accept it, and that's fine. You know, that's really okay. I have to learn at times to be alone and not be lonely. That can be hard. But it can be done. It absolutely can be done. Let's move on, because man, what time do we have this room until?
Five.
Jeez, we're not, oh my God.
No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. Thank you, man. All right. No pressure, huh? All right. God alone, I'm at the bottom of 69, God alone, right? No, yeah. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we are going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only a half truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and we will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. Over and over again in this book, you learn that if you have a problem and you don't know what to do about it, go help somebody else. Go be of service to the next sick person. You don't know how to do a 10-step call. You're not on the 10-step yet. You don't know how to do a 10-step to lower the emotional level. You can help somebody else. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced that now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you have already made a decision, step 3, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, step 4, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Now, step 5, someone you pick, it's a lot easier to get somebody today than it was in 1939 to take your 5th step because this is a more universally known thing. But if you take a look at it, we need somebody that is informed. And what does informed mean? They know the program. If they don't know the program, there's no, you know, unless you have a priest or a minister that you want to give it to that may not the program, if this is what you're okay with, that's fine. Or a rabbi, whatever it is, that's fine. But try to get somebody that knows the program. There are priests and ministers and rabbis that know the program. They do. And you have to find somebody who's uninvolved, unaffected. In other words, let's just say, for example, me and Dean have been married for 20 years. And Michelle over there is best friends with Dean. Is Michelle the best person for me to do a 5th step with? Absolutely not. Because this is her best friend. If you think I've been married to Dean for all these years and I'm not going to have a few resentments against her at this point, that would be foolish. So Dean would not be someone that I would want to do a 5th step with because she'll be affected. She'll absolutely be affected. Now Barbara over here has never met Dean in her life, doesn't know Dean from the front door, and she really knows the program. So Barbara would be the much better choice for me to do my 5th step with than Michelle. So that's how that goes. Steps 6 and 7. Steps 6 and 7. I'm going quickly here again. If you want, when I get home, you email me. You want all my podcasts on all these chapters. I will email you every podcast from Vision for You that I've ever done, except step 12, which I did last week, and I don't have it on this list yet, unless my sponsor knows how to put it on there. He's a tech guy. He knows how to He can make a computer do ballet. He is amazing. He can make it sing two arias from Aida. Okay, now. 76, if we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. When ready, we say something like this. If you want to say it with me, go ahead. And this is where your amen will come in. My Creator, I am now willing you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have completed step seven. Now step eight is a very definite, separate step. And when you go to most step study meetings and they start talking about eight, they'll move the conversation right over to nine. Eight and six are the most passed over steps. But eight is a definite step because I'm going to make a list of the people I have harmed. And I have done a lot of things in my life which I am deeply ashamed of. I wrote a lot of bad checks. I lied. I was as abusive to my own mother as I could have been. I blamed her for everything. I took out on her any pain in my life. She immediately was feeling my wrath. I have a memory when I was about 10 years old, we were playing baseball with a rubber ball, not a league, but a rubber ball, and I was pitching and I thought, wouldn't it be funny if instead of pitching the ball to the batter, I threw it at the kids watching us play. And I wanted to make them laugh, and I did, and everybody laughed except little Wendell, because I hit him right in the solar plexus, and he was 4 years old. And he cried, and I felt this big. I have regretted that from that moment until today. I regret what I did. What a bully, what a coward I was that day to throw the ball at little Wendell. All he was a little kid from the neighborhood that wanted to be our friend. There weren't a lot of kids in the neighborhood his age. Most of the kids were a little older than him. So he wanted to hang out with us and watch us play because he loved us and he looked up to us. And we would let him read we would read comic books with him. He was 4 years old, he couldn't read, but we would read comic books with him and we would play games with him and we were nice to him, but I made him cry and it was like I defiled him. It was like I turned on him when I hurt him. And I regret that. I was as abusive to my mother as I could have been. I wanted Laura Petrie, and I got Virginia Grabowski. I was not always nice to people. I have to look at that and see the terrible destructiveness that the food caused. Step nine. I don't have the time to go through the chapter of step nine. I don't. But I'm going to just talk about step nine. Made direct amends, eyeball to the people I had harmed. Now, sometimes there are people in our past that we cannot make amends to. My mother, I could not make amends to my mother because she was dead when I came into this program. And by the time I really started working the steps in earnest, she was dead quite a long time. I was as abusive to her as I could have been. I blamed her for everything. I've already told you that. And for a long time, between, say, the middle 80s to 1994, December of 94, I worked it out in my mind that I didn't choose her as a mother. And then something very special happened on December 14th, 1994, 4:27 p.m. in Eugene, Oregon, my daughter was born. My daughter was born under horrific conditions. She was jaundiced, but that was the tip of the iceberg. She was premature, and her lungs were not fully developed. And they told us that there could be cerebral palsy. They said developmental delay, blind, deaf. I mean, come on, we're 3,000 miles from home, and we're going to have this kid. And we don't know what the hell is going to happen. We have no support in Eugene, Oregon at all whatsoever. And we didn't know what to expect. And My daughter was born at 4:27 on Company Road before, and they were waiting in the hospital to take her to the neonatal intensive care unit. Is it, just to show you how sick I am, I almost said a waitress, a nurse. A nurse that dried her off, and she said to me, "It does not." Wait, the nurse's name was Janice. I'm still probably still is Janice. But she said to me, "It does not appear the baby is blind or deaf." And I said, "Thank God, thank God." She said, "The only thing now is we have to keep her breathing." She was a belly breather. But she wasn't, her lungs were not fully developed. So she had to go right into the neonatal intensive care unit in Eugene, and she had to go into, they don't call it an incubator anymore, they call it an isolette. And when they give medication to an infant, they don't give it to them in the arms like they would us or the mouth. They give it in the head and the feet. Now when they put her in the little isolette, she was orange. She looked like a pumpkin, you see. Not like that, but darker than that, much darker than that, more pumpkin color than that. And she started thrashing around. And at once it just hit me like a ton of bricks how much I hurt my mother. Here was this little child coming to me, letting me know how much I hurt my own mother. And for the first and only time in my life at that moment, I had the idea that my mother also did not choose her mental illness either. And that I kept thinking about what I lost out on by having a crazy mother. And I started thinking about what she lost out on by having a bastard son. And by having this mental illness. My mother could have done great things. My mother had a profound effect on my life. I put in her obituary, "Proud Chicago," which I knew she would write. If you were watching TV with her, she'll tell you who's from Chicago and who's Jewish in 2 seconds flat. And she was very proud of Chicago. She loved the city of Chicago. She thought it was just the greatest. And people from Chicago, she taught me often, were exalted. Especially if they were from New York. She hated New Yorkers. She loved Chicago. And if you want to get a Chicagoan to rear back on any idea, tell them it came out of New York or LA, and we'll rear back on it every time. And my mother shaped me. My father was very afraid of people. My father had been damaged beyond any comprehension. But my mother would teach me that if you take a Black, a Jew, a Catholic, a Protestant, and an American Indian, and dip them in Lake Michigan, they will be equally wet. And my mother marched in the streets with Harry Jackson, you know, and Harry Jackson, was in my home. And my mother marched in the streets with Harry Jackson to break down some of the barriers of the redlining. Redlining is when they will not give mortgages or insurance to homeowners in certain areas if they're Black or Jewish or Catholic or what have you. So my mother did teach me through example, and she molded a lot of my politics. She molded a lot of my politics. It hurts me because of the things that she taught me. It really hurts me to go to a convention in Los Angeles or to go to a convention in Boston, Massachusetts, which have very high minority populations, and there's not a Black face in the crowd. We are better when we are different. We are better when we are together as different people. And this I got from her. It just hurts me that we haven't reached out effectively enough. In my area, there are Native American people that are dying of this illness, and there's not one Native American face in OA in Arizona today that I know of. And that hurts me. That hurts me tremendously. There are 3 or 4 people that come to our meetings that are African American. Phoenix, Arizona is a big city. What the hell? What the hell? I mean, come on, we have to do a better job. But I have to, how do I make amends to my mother for this? Because that's what we're talking about. How do I make amends to her? I make amends to her by living my life according to the creeds that she would have wanted for me, by being here today, by taking care of my life, by doing the right things, by staying out of the food. I mean, my God, these are pants that are what, 30, 40 inches smaller than what I used to wear, for God's sakes? I mean, I'm wearing clothes that come from a normal store. She would be thrilled. She wouldn't really know me today because it's been so long since she died. She died in 1936. But the bottom line is I have to know that when I do those right things, that I am pleasing her, and whether or not she's looking down on me from heaven, she is pleased that I'm here today. She is pleased at who my daughter is. She is pleased at the life that I live today. If everything you said today, everything you did, everywhere you went, everything you ate was on the front page of the Chicago Tribune, are you okay with that? Because if you're not, you're living your life with secrets, and secrets will kill you. Today, I'm living my life as if everything I said, everywhere I went, where do we go for lunch? So there's everywhere we went, everywhere I go, is on the front page of the Chicago Tribune, and I'm okay with that. And that's what would please her today. How do I make amends to me? I know how to make amends to other people. I pay them back. We don't just apologize for taking their money, we pay them back. We know, and some amends cannot be made. You need a good sponsor, or you're going to go out and do more harm than you originally did, and now you're really going to be in a pickle. How do I make amends to me? Because this is one of the things that I get asked over. How do I make amends to myself? I make amends to myself by getting my toughest up in the morning and getting on that Vision for You meeting and doing what I need to do to run my business and doing what I need to do to be a friend to my friends, to be a potential boyfriend to this girl, to this lady, to be a right human being. And by doing self-esteemable actions, I start to like me. Working with others, paying my bills, owning my responsibilities. When I look at me now, I like me. That doesn't come overnight. That doesn't come because I make a decision, you know, I'm going to like me now. It doesn't come for me that way. Maybe that works that way for you. It doesn't work that way for me. I do action every flipping day that makes me closer to God and further away from the food. And in taking that action, it gives me peace to be who I am. I missed out on a lot. Good Lord, did I miss. My friends could tell you stories of the girls they were out with in high school. And they could tell you stories about the girls they had in college. I can't tell you any of those stories because I never had anybody. I never went on a date. They could tell you stories about all this. I got no stories. I got nothing. But what I have is today, my life is full. Today, my phone doesn't stop ringing. Today, I have a life that includes recovery. This is the greatest journey a human being can take. It is the most magnificent journey imaginable. The people and the place, I've been as far north as Wasilla, Anchorage, Alaska. I've been as far south as Boca Raton, Florida. I've been to San Diego, California, and Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and most points in between. I have done big book studies in 38 of the 50 states so far. I come to California quite a bit. I'll be here again in June. I'll be doing the big book study for Region 2, and I have a lot of friends in Southern California. I have a lot of friends in that San Diego, Orange County area. And the politics in Orange County can be kind of frightening, but the bottom line is, but it's very different. But anyway, let's get to step 10. Okay, if there's two steps that are the most ignored, they are 2 and 10. 2 and 10. Let's go to page 84. Let's blow the doors off all the myths about step 10. One of the things that's very sad about step 10 is this myth that it's something that you do at night and in the morning. That's step 11, not step 10. That's step 11. Very briefly, what we're going to say here is this. This thought, I'm in the middle of, I don't even have time to do the promises. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. Now, here's the first myth in step 10 we're going to smash through, is that you don't do 10 till you're done with 9. If you're doing 9 and you're not doing 10 and 11, you're going to eat again, because these amends are going to bring up emotions. You're afraid to make them. You're angry. You feel injustice. You feel all these feelings. And as these emotions build up, you are going to eat again. So you start, what step do we use to clean up the past? 8 and 9, right? 8 and 9. So as we begin 9, which should be about 10 minutes after we do 5, which should be about 10 minutes after we do 4, which shouldn't take more than about 2-3 hours. One of the biggest mistakes we see in sponsorship is going way too slow, introducing way too much information, way too many different things. Fast, andale, schnell, schnell, schnell. Get them to a spiritual awakening. Get them to 10, 11, and 12, because that's where you live. So we're going to vigorously commence this way of living, step 10, as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. I'm getting sick and tired of getting these calls from people. Well, I've worked all the steps. Well, are you still working them? Obviously not. Well, I already did them. No. No, we do this for our lifetime. This is every day. When it's time to stop, we'll let you know. We'll tap you on the shoulder. I have a friend of mine. Her name is Naomi B. I'm going to see Naomi at the convention for Vision in September. I love Naomi. She came to my big book study when she was brand new in recovery, and it was in New Jersey. Kim G was there, if you know who Kim G is. And yeah. They were there, and she walked up to me on the lunch break. This was a Friday night, Saturday, Sunday deal. She walks up to me on the lunch break on Saturday, and she says, "When I'm done with the steps, can I call you?" And I says, "No." And she looked at me like I was from Mars, and I said, "Because when you're done with the steps, you'll be dead." The steps are something we do every day of our life. Hang on. Okay, go ahead, or I'll feel bad.
Could you please clarify what you were saying about doing steps 8, 9, and 10? And 11 concurrently?
You start 10 the minute you're done with 7. Okay. As soon as you, it says we vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. What steps do we use to clean up the past? 8 and 9. Here's your instruction. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. What step did we encounter selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear? 4 is correct. When these things crop up, not if, when these things crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. What 2 steps did we use to ask God to remove defects of character? 6 and 7. 6 and 7. We discuss them with someone at night. We discuss them with someone the next day. We discuss them with someone next Tuesday. Or we discuss them with somebody immediately. So that means that we don't wait till the night, or we don't wait till the morning. We do our 10th step immediately. What step did asked us to discuss something with someone immediately? 5. So far we've done 4, 5, 6, and 7. And make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. What 2 steps do we use to make amends? 8 and 9. So in this little sub-paragraph, we've done 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Then we resolutely means with purpose, turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Step 12, love and tolerance of others is our code. I dare you to do 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 12, 5, 6 times a day and eat O. Henry bars. You can't do it. You can't do it. You cannot do it. You cannot do it. Now, this is how you tell if you are recovered compulsive overeater. It says here, and we've ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. And we will find that this has happened automatically. These are the 10-step promises. we will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky, nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. And how do we keep in fit spiritual condition? By doing these things every single day, many times a day. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we have become God-conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. We must go further, and that means more action, not thinking. This is not a program for people who do it. This is not a program for people who need it. This is a program for people who do it. This is a program of action. There's no chapter into thinking, into needing, or into wanting. But there is a chapter into action. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. You shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than us are using it constantly. It works. By the way, I hope I've made clear in step 10 that this is something we do as needed. You don't wait till the morning and you don't wait till the evening. You do it as it's needed. And in most buildings, you have cathedrals. Some have men on the door and some have women on the door. But you have cathedrals where you can go in with your cell phone and you can make a call and you can do a 10-step call with somebody provided they know how to do one. And it shouldn't be that difficult. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. Pretty self-explanatory. Now this is the on awakening part, and one of you or five of you are going to ask me, why is the nighttime part before the day part? It's because it is assumed that you've been doing step 10s throughout the day. It's assumed that you've been doing 10s throughout the day. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. We ask God for inspiration, intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We are often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still and experienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it's not probable we're going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, thank you, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely on it. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. What I had to do was I had to shift around something that had been going on in my entire life. I spent my entire life telling God how big my problems were, and now I have to tell my problems how big my God is. My God is huge. My God is bigger than any problems I might have. And I rely upon that God. Do things go my way all the time? They do not. Do things go my way an adequate number of times? I hope not. I want them to go God's way. I do not want what I want. I want what God wants. God sees the bigger picture. He knows what I need. He knows how to run the universe. If circumstances warrant, page 87, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination, which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles. The principles are the steps. We have been discussing, there are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, "Thy will be done." We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did. We are trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. This is the most important paragraph in the book. It works. It really does. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. But this is not all. There's action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. Now we have 9 minutes left. We're going to talk about step 12 and then we'll be done, which I know will make some of you angry. Let's go to step 12, and what we're going to see is this is a definite three-part step. The first part is having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. If you haven't had a spiritual awakening as a result of the first 11 steps, you shouldn't be sponsoring. If you have had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, then you should be sponsoring. This is not an 11-step program. It is a 12-step program, and it is vital for my survival to do all the steps. And some of the greatest rewards of my life have come by working with other people. And there are many, many things that is very, very important for me to remember in step 12. You are uniquely qualified to carry this message. There are people, and they are suffering. This is a debilitating, this is a murderous disease that doesn't give a damn who it strikes down. This disease will take you, and this disease will do things to you that you wouldn't do to your worst enemy. And there are people who have been to the psychiatrist and the therapist, and they've been to the gym, and they've been to the surgeon, and they've been to the Weight Watchers, and they've been to COP, and they've done it all. They've had bariatric surgery, and they're about to kill themselves because they can't get out of the way of this juggernaut. And they've thrown themselves together to come to a Tuesday meeting. You don't know how to sponsor? You stick your hand out and you say, "Jojo, I'm Harlan. Welcome to the meeting. I've never seen you here before. I'm glad you're here." You know how to do that. Dr. Bob, at the end of his life, he bequeathed us with something we can lean on for the rest of our lives. Dr. Bob said, at the very last, "Let's keep this simple, that these complications are of only interest to the psychologist, the clinician." He said, "Let's keep it simple, and let's make sure that we remember that what this boils down to is love and service. We all know what love is, and we all know what service is." He says that let's always be on guard for that erring member among us, the tongue. Let's use it judiciously to help the person up to the rung on the ladder on which you now stand. And he left us that. that it is a pleasure, it is a duty, and it helps repay the person that brought the message to me. I have memories of many things in life, but I'm reminded that we are always carrying a message. Whether we think we're carrying one, whether we want to be carrying one, we are carrying a message, and we're either spreading the disease or we're carrying the message of the recovery. Now, I told you that I had 18 years and my daughter is 22. When my daughter was 19 months old, we were living in Eugene, Oregon, and as soon as I came out to Oregon, I started going into relapse. And my daughter was in diapers. It was a Sunday morning, like tomorrow morning, and my ex-wife had just done a major shop at a grocery store that we lived near in Eugene, Oregon. And she was putting away massive, massive amounts of groceries, and my little daughter, with her precious little hand, she was getting a message from me, and she picked up her hand and she put it on the refrigerator, and her mother was standing here, she's standing there, she opens up the refrigerator, she turns her head and she says, "Shit, Esther, there's nothing in here." That was the message. That was the message that I was bringing that little precious child who looked exactly like my father then and looks exactly like him now. But that was the message that I was passing to this precious child, that I wouldn't hurt, for any reason or any motivation in the world, I wouldn't hurt this kid.
Sometimes.
The bottom line is, that was the message. A few years later, I'm in beautiful recovery, and there was a show on, there was a television program about a guy and his brother that won the lottery, and they had a list in their pocket of all the people they did bad things to, and they wanted to get in good with karma. So they went around with their list, and they blah, 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 and each episode was about how they were making an amends to various people because they wanted karma to be repaid for them winning the lottery. She looked at the TV, she looks at me, she looks at the TV, she looks at me, and she says, "Those guys are just doing their eighth and ninth step, right, Dad?" Without a word from me, without a word from me. And remember this, any idiot can count the seeds in an apple, but only God can count the apples in a seed that you never know. I'm going to tell you a story about my friend Scott. Scott was an actor on Broadway in New York, and he was Jewish, but he looked very, very Latin. Dark skin, dark hair, dark curly hair. When he would walk in, the girls would just they would faint dead away. He was about 6'2", and he had that black curly hair and the dark skin. They went nuts when he would walk into the room. They'd start giggling and flipping their hair. Oh my God, they went nuts. Well, he found an actress in New York on Broadway, and he married her. And they came out to Los Angeles to make their fortune. They were going to be in the movies and blah, blah, blah. He's dead now. He came into OA later. He was in AA, and he was a drug addict and an alcoholic. And then in sobriety, he got up to about 300 pounds and he came into OA, and that's where I bumped up against him. But he went out on a call one night. It was a Saturday night, and he goes out on a call from the AA group in Los Angeles to East Los Angeles to a motel room in East LA. Very bad part of town, tough part of town. He goes out there with this other guy, and they go visit this guy in a motel that had called the AA office. And this guy is falling asleep, but he's drunk. But they talk to this guy for about an hour. And they're talking and talking and talking and talking. But he's falling asleep, so they determine he's not a danger to himself. He's not a danger to anybody else. They're just going to let him sleep and they're going to leave. 5 years later, Scott is speaking at an Alcathon in San Diego, California. And he was the speaker, and his session ended at noon, and they were going to break for lunch. He gets done. Guy comes up to him, says, "Are you Scott?" He says, "Yes." He says, "You saved my life." Uh-oh. He says, "You saved my life." Scott says to him, "I don't believe I know you." He says, "Do you remember 5 years ago when you went to that motel in East LA and you were talking to that guy sitting on the bed?" He says, "Oh yeah, I remember." He said, "Well, that guy died. I was hiding under the bed. And I heard every word you said, and I haven't had a drink since. Any idiot can count the seeds in an apple, but only God can count the apples in a seed. You don't know what you're going to start, what chain reaction you're going to start when you go out there and you do 12-step work. You just don't know. You don't know. There are so many suffering people, and it is the greatest way of life there is. You talk to somebody, to that person, to the world, you're a person. To that person, you can be the world. You can light them up. You can give them hope. You can give them identification. Give them of yourself. That maybe there's hope for this person. They've been to the place where they get their jaw wired shut. They've been to the bariatric surgeon. They've been to the hypnotist. They've been to the psychiatrist, but you can give them something that those people could not give them, and you can look them in the face and say, I have in recovery for X amount of time. They've never heard anybody like that. They've never been exposed to that before. You can do it. All it takes is a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, and to carry this message, not a message, not some message, this message. This is the only message we have. This is the message of the program, the big book of AA. If you want my message, you'll die in the food. I am not a soothsayer. I am not anything like that. You have this message. If you don't know how to sponsor, well, the doctor's opinion, chapters 1, 2, and 3 are step 1. Chapter 4 is step 2. Chapter 5 is steps 3 and 4. Chapter 6 is 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And chapter 7 is step 12. Is that so complicated? Let the book do the work. Let the book do the work is the key. And this is important, and this is what we're going to close with before we do the final benediction on page 164. You owe. On June the 10th, 1935, a spark was struck in Akron, Ohio. Passed from one unworthy hand to one unworthy hand to another unworthy hand. That spark reached a guy in Oxnard, California, named Jim Willis. And Jim Willis knew, because he was a gambler, he knew that gamblers needed a program where they could come and identify that we're not alcoholics. And he started a program called Gamblers Anonymous. And he started this program, and he was on a television show which ran in November of 1959. And in November of 1959, there were 5 recovered gamblers on a show with their faces hidden on a show called The Paul Coates Show. Watching was a overweight housewife in West Los Angeles, California, named Roseanne S. She knew that her husband Marvin had a friend who was a gambler. And she thought that if they would take him to a meeting of Gamblers Anonymous, it might help him. And so they did. And as Roseanne sat in the back of that room at a meeting of Gamblers Anonymous in 1959, she heard people saying things that she believed were secret unto her, and she walked up to Jim Willis, who just happened to be at that meeting, founder to founder, Jim and Roseanne, and she said to Jim, Jim, do you think a program like yours would help people like me with food? And Jim Willis turned to Roseanne and said, you know, Roseanne, I don't see why not. And on January 19th, 1960, was the very first meeting ever of a new program called Overeaters Anonymous. Independently, two years later, in Luling, Texas, there was a man, and his name was A.G. Ainsworth. And he was in Luling, Texas, and he had just been on a silent retreat at his church with his friend Robert. And A.G. was not an alcoholic. This was an AA retreat. He was not an alcoholic, but he was a compulsive overeater. And he was on this retreat with Robert and others. And on the way home, it was Sunday after the retreat, they had decided that they were going to stop to a bakery and get some stuff to binge on. And A.G. really had hit bottom. And he said to Robert, he tried to phrase it in a way that was almost kidding, so if Robert attacked him on it, you know, that he could say, well, I was just kidding. He said to Robert, Robert, do you think a program like AA would help somebody like me that has a problem with food? And Robert heard the pain in AG's voice, and he said, AG, I don't see why not. And in 1962, well, before this, but they started, there was another woman in Luling, Texas named Norma B. And Norma B. and A.G. Ainsworth started a program called Gluttons Anonymous. And there were five groups of Gluttons Anonymous. And by this time, there were 16 groups of Overeaters Anonymous. And A.G. Ainsworth called the Central Office of Alcoholics Anonymous in New York. And he wanted to inquire if they knew of anybody that was using the AA 12 steps for a food program. And they put him in touch with Roseanne, and on a Sunday afternoon, they gathered around in Luling, Texas, and called Roseanne, and Roseanne and AG agreed that it was like Stanley finding Livingston. AG became the first man in OA, not because he accomplished anything so great, but because the original charter of OA didn't let men in. It was only for women. He flew in on his private jet. He was a businessman. They were a bunch of housewives. And they incorporated Overeaters Anonymous. Sandy B. laid the groundwork for getting it registered as a nonprofit. And at the first business conference, A.G. Ainsworth became the first chairman of the Board of Trustees of Overeaters Anonymous. The vote was 16-5 on the name. 16 voted for Overeaters Anonymous, 5 voted for Gluttons Anonymous, and we've been Overeaters Anonymous since that day. In an unlikely chain of events, the message got to you. You owe. You must pass it on. It is very, very important that you pass it on. This is the most glorious way of life imaginable. Test God. Show God what you're willing to do, and you will see miracles beyond your wildest dreams. Beyond Your Wildest Dreams, I use specifically because that is the title of Roseanne's book that tells the story that I just told you and a lot more that I didn't tell you today. Let's go to page 164, and we'll be done for the day. Next time I come up here, let's do Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, okay? None of this one day stuff. None of this one day stuff. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Step 1, 2, and 3. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. 4, 5, 6, 7, clear, 8, 9. Clear away the wreckage of your past. 10, 11, and 12. Give freely, 10 and 11. Give freely of what you find and join us. 12. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for all the work you did to make this possible. Thank you. Thank you.